Lev Brudnoy happened to be in Moscow, applying for his second tour of duty at Leningrad, when the desperate corporate personnel director caught sight of him. Handsome, red-haired, charming, young enough to appear dashing, old enough to appear knowledgeable, Brudnoy would make the ideal image of the new Russian space pioneer. After all, the man wanted to return to Leningrad, no? Why did he want to return to the moon? Some said he realized that this new frontier was humankind's great new challenge and opportunity. Others said it was to make the extra salary so he could pay his gambling debts. At least three different women were certain that handsome Lev was running off to the moon to escape from them, although none of them knew of the other two. No matter what his reasons, the corporate personnel chief knew a media star when she saw one. She interviewed Lev extensively, often in bed, and then unleashed him as the new Russian icon, the space traveler, the lunar explorer, the man of the future. In his way, Lev helped to raise billions for Leningrad. He became an international television celebrity. When he went to Leningrad, he brought virtual reality equipment with him so he could escort earthbound visitors through the facility and show them the stark grandeur of the moon's harshly beautiful environment. The Leningrad that he showed was mostly a television studio's carefully prepared set, a heavily cosmeticized version of the grubby reality of the cramped, stuffy, overheated, and underfinanced underground shelters that composed the true Leningrad. Money flowed in for Leningrad. Not enough to really expand the base, but enough to keep it staggering along. Scientists came to the moon and departed. Geologists and metallurgists explored the wide expanses around Leningrad. In Moscow, the board of directors, chaired now by the woman who had been personnel director, published glowing full-color brochures of the glorious future of Leningrad. Like many tragedies, Brudnoy's success came crashing down when he went one single step too far. He shuttled back and forth to Leningrad so often that he became known worldwide as the Moon Man. Inevitably, on a certain global television broadcast, he was asked the fateful question, "When will tourists be allowed to visit Leningrad?" "Why not now?" was his immediate unthinking reply. Within hours, the offices of NPO Leningrad were deluged with requests for visits to the base on the moon. For the first time in ages, the Russians had scored a public relations triumph over the West. Tourists to the moon! It was fantastic, but it promised to be profitable. Even at a cost of millions, there were wealthy individuals who, bored with the Great Wall of China and Antarctica and the space stations in low Earth orbit, simply had to see the moon firsthand. Brudnoy led the first contingent himself. Their complaints started even before the booster rocket took off from Baikonur. There were no hotels. They were expected to sleep in barracks like cosmonauts or scientists. Leningrad was small, crowded, smelled bad. The food was awful. There weren't enough spacesuits for everyone to go out for a walk on the moon's surface at the same time. They had to take turns. And the suits stank. On and on, a litany of complaints that went all the way back to Mother Russia and over the television networks to the rest of the world. Lunar tourism was set back 20 years. Leningrad was exposed as a dirty, dangerous, crowded, and unwholesome frontier outpost. Lev Brudnoy was accused of fronting for a fraud. Lawsuits were actually started by several of the American tourists, although the Russian government quietly quashed them, with Washington's even quieter acquiescence. Lev Brudnoy became a pariah. He was no longer welcome in the Moscow offices of NPO Leningrad, nor in the beds of women who had adored him only weeks earlier. Then came the most tragic blow of all. Their finances ruined, NPO Leningrad declared bankruptcy. Leningrad would shut down. Permanently. Lev was at Leningrad when the terrible news came. Most of the skeleton crew of scientists and cosmonauts did not blame him exactly, but they did not console him either. Deep in his heart, Lev knew he had done nothing truly wrong, and he wanted to continue his life as a lunatic. So he commandeered one of the last rocket vehicles left at Lunograd, reprogrammed its guidance computer with his own hands, and flew it in one long ballistic arc to Moonbase, where he asked for asylum. The people at Moonbase had seen Lev on television, of course. They immediately took a liking to the big, lovable, red-headed Russian. Besides, they had no way to get him back to Lunograd. Lev's rocket transport could be refueled, of course, but somehow its guidance computer had broken down as soon as the craft had landed at Moonbase. After somewhat frenzied discussions with Savannah, Moscow, and Washington, it was decided that Lev could become a Masterson Corporation employee without losing his Russian citizenship. But it was all kept very quiet. Lev's days as a television idol were over. He became a regular visitor to Moonbase, working there 6 months at a time, then spending a month Earthside. He even returned to Moscow, but only briefly. Too many women were waiting for him there. Mare Nubium. A part of his mind wanted to giggle. I must be going crazy, Paul thought. Yet it was slightly ludicrous, leaning against the massive boulder, alone on the desolate lunar plain, miles from shelter, running out of oxygen, while the fingers of his right hand wiggled pitifully around the metal collar of his surface suit, trying to reach the water tube. Suppose I die like this. When they finally find me, they'll think I strangled myself. He wanted to laugh, but his throat was too dry for it. Sweat stung his eyes, though. I'm not dehydrated. Not yet. There. His thumb and forefinger grasped the slim plastic tube. It was just below his chin, out of his field of vision. Blinking the sweat away, Paul slowly, carefully slid his fingers along the tube. He could not feel a kink in it. The tube went into the metal collar ring where it connected with the piping that ran inside the suit, across the left shoulder to the water tank and the life support backpack. Maybe when I fell I dislodged the connection in the collar, he guessed. Don't feel any wetness. The tube's not ruptured. He spent several precious minutes searching for kinks in the slim tube, finding none. Must be the connection inside the collar ring, he told himself. No way to get to it. He pushed himself up to a standing position and stared out at the sharp horizon, blazing in unfiltered sunlight. Must be at least another 10 miles to go. Without water, I won't make it. He held up his forearm display panel. In the shade of the boulder, the temperature was 180 below zero. But just a foot away, in the sunlight, it was over 200 above, he knew, and still rising. His mouth was parched. Can't go 10 more miles in the sunshine without drinking water. You'll dehydrate and collapse. Okay, he said to himself. If it is to be, it's up to me. You know what you've got to do. Make it quick and do it right. You won't get 2 chances. If the water tube was no longer properly connected inside the collar ring, the only way to fix the problem was to reset the collar. Inside a shelter, or even in an airlock, Paul would have unlocked the collar seal, taken off his helmet, checked the connection to make certain it wasn't blocked or broken, then put the helmet back on and sealed it tight again. Out here in the vacuum of the lunar surface, he didn't have that luxury. But I can do most of it, he told himself, if I'm quick enough. Painfully, he wormed his arm back into its sleeve and wriggled his fingers back into the glove. Then he stood still, breathing hard, swiftly going through the emergency procedure in his mind. It works in the procedures manual, he told himself. Now let's see if it works for real. He took one long last breath, then exhaled slowly. Holding his breath, he clicked open the seal of the collar ring and slid the helmet half a turn as if he were going to take it off. A slight hiss of air made every nerve in his body tighten. But he held the helmet for a moment that seemed years long, then twisted it back to the closed position and snapped the seal shut again. The hissing stopped, and Paul took a big, grateful gulp of oxygen. Then he turned his head to the left and found the nipple of the water tube with his lips. Carefully he sipped. Water. Just a dribble,